According to the Guinness Book of World Records, the Bible is the best-selling book of all time. And by a long way, with an estimated 5 billion copies sold around the globe. And interestingly, sales of Bibles have risen sharply during the coronavirus pandemic. There are many possible explanations for this. Perhaps the Bible is another of those books we always meant to make time to read, like War and Peace or Proust, and now we have had that time. Perhaps for some it works as a kind of talisman, as it has done since antiquity. The content matters less than the physical presence of a holy object which can help to keep us safe, like a St. Christopher necklace for some drivers. Perhaps some people may want to check whether the virus is predicted in the Book of Revelation. This last possibility reminds us that you can generally find in the Bible whatever you're looking for. The Bible shapeshifts according to our demands. In crises, there's a tendency to go back to such a venerable source of illumination and look for whatever will meet your needs. We saw the same thing after the attacks of the 11th of September 2001, when there was also a spike in Bible sales. The Canadian writer Northrop Frye wrote of the Bible, "This huge, sprawling, tactless book sits there inscrutably in the middle of our cultural heritage, frustrating all our efforts to walk around it." And so it does. In a secular age, it's surprising how much interest there still is in the Bible. Even those who do not believe in Christianity continue to be fascinated by its presence, as the celebrations for the fourth centenary of the King James Bible in 2011 showed. For believers, the Bible is seen as being inspired by God and having a high level of authority in matters of belief and practice. For many non-believers, it survives as an omnipresent trace or ghost at the edges of popular and literate culture. It's known in fragments as the source of quotations and allusions. Journalists can still assume that their readers will recognize the meaning of a David and Goliath contest, or pick up references to the love of money as being the root of all evil, though they may not know where the allusions come from, often thinking that some are from Shakespeare. I'm sure the listener would recognize, for example, phrases such as, "Am I my brother's keeper?" or "Man does not live by bread alone," or "No peace for the wicked." But would they know they were all biblical quotes from the books of Genesis, Deuteronomy, and Job, respectively? The Bible has not died out of popular culture, as secularists might have predicted. Oxford University Press alone sells 250,000 Bibles in the King James Version every year. It's striking how often atheists commend it, even as they dissociate themselves from its religious claims. Even Professor Richard Dawkins evidently approves of its cultural status, and Philip Pullman campaigns to retain the teaching of biblical stories and parables in schools. From its remote beginnings in folklore and myth, to its reception and interpretation in the present day, the Bible has been read and used both in its original languages and in translation. It's the product of a long and intriguing process. As we shall see, few, if any, of the biblical books are the result of simple composition by one author. So, then, the Bible is not one book, but a collection of books. We know this in theory, but faced with a modern edition bound between two imposing black leather covers, we tend to think of it as a single work. Yet the word Bible is, in origin, a plural, ta biblia, in Greek, meaning the books. In origin, each book is a single unit, written on a single scroll, and even the arrangement of the books varies among different ancient manuscripts. Over the week ahead, I'll be exploring how the books of the Bible came to be written, who wrote them, and why. In the enthusiastic celebrations for the King James Bible 9 years ago, I sometimes suspected that people thought the King James's translators had actually written the Bible themselves, as if it were a book from the 17th century. In reality, parts of the Old Testament may go back to the 10th or 11th century BC. while more or less all of the New Testament comes from the very first century AD. As we shall see, neither of the two religions, Judaism and Christianity, that claim the biblical books as their foundation, derive simply from the Bible alone. Indeed, the Bible contains many elements that are problematic for both Jewish and Christian belief. These include morally objectionable features that are widely known, such as God's destruction of innocent people in the stories of the Israelite conquest of the Promised Land, but less controversially, also its lack of uniformity given the number and variety of genres the Bible contains, from narrative and prophecy to poetry and letters. Actually, very little of the Bible tells you what to believe. It's more oblique than that. The Bible doesn't map directly onto the Christian faith. There are central ideas in Christian belief, take the doctrine of the Trinity, as we'll see later, that are barely even hinted at in the Bible. And there are central ideas in the Bible that don't appear in the Christian creeds. For example, the extensive moral teachings of Jesus. Christianity and its Bible don't conflict with each other, but they are certainly not identical. The same is true of the Old Testament and its relationship with Judaism. Judaism has the Old Testament, or better to call it the Hebrew Bible, as its foundational text and as a major resource. But there's a lot in Judaism that doesn't arise directly from the Bible. Both faiths contain non-biblical elements. Some Protestants claim that their whole faith derives from the Bible, but in practice, this isn't really the case. Catholics, like Jews, don't in fact make this claim. They believe instead that tradition supplements the Bible. The extent to which the Old Testament remains an authority for Christians and, if it does, how then it is to be read alongside the new ideas introduced by Jesus, St. Paul, and others, is a major issue for Christian thinkers. There's just one verse in the New Testament that speaks of the Old Testament as inspired by God, literally God-breathed, but Christians have often made much of this one sentence and the idea of God as the author of these books. To call the Bible inspired implies that God had a hand in its production, but exactly how that worked in practice is seldom defined. As I said, references to its God-breathed inspiration are very rare in the Bible itself. Prophets do indeed declaim, "Thus says the Lord," but in a lot of the Bible there's no suggestion that God is actually the author. Many books, such as Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, are obviously human reflections on one's relationship with God, not teaching given by God per se. And the Psalms are a great storehouse of prayers and praises directed towards God, rather than coming from God. In subsequent episodes, I'll look at the origins of the New and Old Testament books, at how they came together to form a canon of scriptures, and at how Jews and Christians have interpreted them. Many ways of reading the Bible today ignore these questions. Both within religious groups and churches, and in wider society, people tend to take short passages, even single verses, out of context, as though they were oracles that could be applied directly to modern circumstances. This has happened in many recent debates, for example about abortion, or same-sex relationships, or even climate change. In investigating the history of the Bible, we're seeking instead to see the biblical books within the parameters of their own time. This doesn't mean they have nothing to say in our own time. No one would say such a thing about Shakespeare or about ancient Greek tragedies or about other work from the past that we recognize as profound and important, as the Bible surely is too. But it does mean that our experience is enriched by getting to know something about the original context and circumstances in which the books were composed, and trying to understand how they actually functioned within that original context. The letters of St. Paul, for example, deal with issues that were contentious within the context of the churches in the first century. That doesn't mean we can't draw lessons from them for the church today. because these are weighty works that go on being significant, not occasional pieces like a casual email or modern-day blog post. It does, however, mean that we must distinguish between the world, say, St. Paul found himself in, and the one that we inhabit today. The Bible comes to us from a remote culture, or rather from several remote cultures, given that it was probably composed in total over a period of about 1,000 years. They were cultures in which what we would now call religious questions were central in a way they hardly are today. But human nature remains sufficiently constant that when we read their words, we can empathize with the questions they were asking. Questions about the meaning and purpose of life and of how we ought to live. For most of us, these books have to be read in translation. The Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew, plus a few passages in the related language of Aramaic. The New Testament was written in Greek, which by then was the common language of the Mediterranean world. The first translation of the Old Testament appeared as early as the 3rd century BC, a translation from the original Hebrew into Greek for Jews living in Egypt, who surprisingly already no longer knew much Hebrew. It's interesting to note that ever since then, most people who have read the Bible anywhere in the world have read it in a language other than the original, and we all know that much can be lost in translation. Even the King James or Authorized version was not by any means the first translation into English, which the translators themselves were the first to acknowledge. Those 17th century wordsmiths depended on several earlier translations, and especially on that of William Tyndale in the 16th century. Many of his memorable phrases reappeared in the King James version, though sadly some were deemed too imaginative for them. I must say, I'm sorry we lost "The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a lucky fellow." The modern English-speaking reader is spoiled for choice, since there are dozens of English translations on the market. Anyone who is serious about reading the Bible is probably best served by having two. A traditional version, like King James or its modern descendant, the New Revised Standard Version, and a modern translation made from scratch, such as the New English Bible. That way, readers get to enjoy both the traditional resonance of a classic English text, but also experience one that approximates more to the original Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. The fact is that we know a lot more now about those ancient languages than did the King James translators, brilliant linguists though they were. My hope is, then, that over these 5 episodes of A History of the Bible, the audience will be reminded how endlessly fascinating and intriguing the Bible is, whether or not they accept its religious claims.